Good evening, everyone. I hope we've had a chance to read this text. Is everyone present who has the book and has had an opportunity? Great, that makes it much easier to go forward. Were any questions left over from last week about how karma works in terms of from causes and conditions and propelling factors and all those things that come together to make things actually emerge? All right. Well, our next topic is about where they emerge from. So the Yogacara's school contribution to karmic theory. And so that Yogacara, we all studied, everybody here, I think, is familiar with the Mahayana school called Mind Only. We looked at that a little bit earlier. In fact, when we studied the slogans that comes out of the Mind Only school, a teacher was the proponent of Mind Only. Mind Only is saying that basically there's nothing outside mind. I mean, nothing that we experience is anywhere other than mind. Does that make sense? Because that's a really key point. Is that clear?
Say that again, Michael.
Nothing that we experience or know or encounter is outside of mind. Anything that arises is mind. Anything that appears and dwells and ceases is mind. Experience is mind. Thoughts are mind. Feelings are mind. Does that make sense? I mean, in other words, it's a way of understanding how mind is so important. If we know our mind, then we know who we are, because we are mind. Right? Does that make sense? Any reservations? Well, you know, I mean, for instance, the way it was put, but he points out here, this is not a soul, right? But he introduces something here which we haven't really discussed, well, we've been touched on it before, that mind is basically more than just the moment. I mean, it contains other things. And when we talk about where things come from in terms of karma, how things emerge, where are they coming from? We're talking about an aspect of mind. And that aspect is called the alaya, or alaya. We talked about that when we studied the slogans, rest in the nature of alaya. So there's different alayas. We touched on the fact that there are different kinds of alayas, but the one he's talking about is what's called the eighth consciousness. So we have, in other words, we have the five consciousnesses: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, either sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, right? And then we have mind, the sixth, which is basically organizing these sensory inputs.
That's conceptual, right? It's
conceptual, but it's also organizing, because it just coordinates. It's like, you know, if you were just seeing and, you know, you didn't have a train is coming on the track, you say, oh, great train. No, I mean, this, the mind is telling you, get off the track. Right? You know, that's not a particularly conceptual notion. It's actually about just coordinating your perception so that it's a function of intelligence. So that's fairly easy by itself. Then we have something called seventh consciousness, which we've talked about before, which is more problematic. And it's, in Sanskrit, the term is klishta manas, and it really means, it translates as being afflictive consciousness. And it's afflictive because out of what's happening and out of the fundamental nature of natural intelligence that's present at all times, we have this picking and choosing aspect of ourselves. We have things we like and dislike, and then we have things we reject and accept. And this particular seventh consciousness is fairly biased, and it actually has a lot to do with how we think of being somebody at all, how we have an identity. We'll get to that in a minute. But so then we have this other thing, which is called the eighth consciousness. The eighth consciousness is the alia. And as he says, it's not a soul, but it's a storehouse, because it basically contains more than just what's immediately present. If we've been meditating for any length of time, we begin to see how we are constantly viewing patterns emerging into our mind, right? Mm-hmm. Thought patterns that become very familiar after a while. They're things that we begin to, they're just like a golf course. You know, you've got 18 holes and you know where you have to go to get there. There are sand traps and there are, you know, other hazards that you could fall into. But the fact is that basically it gets after a while, it gets somewhat familiar, because we encounter these things and we begin to realize they're going on all the time. Now, it takes certain factors to, and this ties into the notion of rebirth, it's like we're not just all sort of starting fresh at the beginning of this any given birth. We have a fresh potential, which is always present, regardless of how old we are, how young we are. But then we also have tendencies or predispositions, and we have ways we go about things that are particular to ourselves. And so these things we call habitual patterns.
And they're eighth consciousness?
Yes. That's where they reside. In other words, it's like a place. It's not like a physical place, but it's like a psychic dimension of where these patterns that sort of we've identified with and decided are real because of prior experiences and various reactions to experiences and impulses and predilections and all kinds of other issues, hates and loves, memories. Memories are really important. Well, they're all there. So what we're looking at is why do things show up? And why do they show up in a way that they do with us being who we are or what we think we are? So one of the things that Rinpoche stated it earlier is that we become what we are as a result of what we do. And then I would also add what we believe in, which informs how we do things. And of course, the whole point about this karma business is that it's actually an opportunity to discover a lot of freedom in our experience, even though we have supports that make things arise. So, you know, that's, we have a family, that's how we got born, that's a support of some sort. We have friends, we have a society, we have a language, we have culture. We have a history. And these things all inform us. They can be supports for understanding in any given moment the elements that are there. And so all of this is part of what we call the fabric of life. And it's interdependent, meaning it's not like one thing creates everything else. It's more like everything is continuously engaged and impending and impacting and informing the moment. So when we actually look at it that way, when we actually begin to see things that way, or arrive at that kind of understanding, we begin to realize that nothing is real of itself. There's no such standalone thing. We've gone through this before, right? I'm just trying to like, we're talking about how interdependence is really important. So in addition to that, we have this collective karma which we partake of. It's not like we are personally responsible to create that collective karma. It's just present.
So I don't think it was in here, but the thing just I've been thinking about is in terms of we have our own patterns, but you know, in some sense, they might have come from previous lifetimes, but also are there patterns that we sort of inherit in various ways from whoever carries us in the womb, whoever raises us? I mean, is that a piece of it, or is that
And genetically.
Yeah.
If we just wanted to look at it from the point of view of having genetic predispositions, which are not necessarily, I mean, depending on how, it's a matter of interpretation to say whether I created this or I chose these parents that gave me this genetic component. But we have these genetic components, and they make up a portion of our experience, and certainly the DNA and RNA are all part of, a functional part of how we operate. So we could say that that's also in the alia as part of the mind stuff.
But I was even thinking just even that that we absorb some of that kind of habitual patterning from the people that we live with. And I think now they actually, some of the research is like some of the emotional stuff that the mother is having while they're carrying a child sort of imprints on the child in like a really like physical way.
That's right. So we take that on or we have it there. The question is whether, I mean, maybe it's an interpretation to question whether we deserve it or not.
Right.
Or whether it just happens, you know, sort of as a simple byproduct of the mere fact that we're here and we had to come into it, have a body.
I think you're talking about the epigenetic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I've done some very interesting studies on.
Say that,
huh? Epigenetics.
And there's no question that as we go on and the world gets more and more polluted and we're dealing with more and more chemical invasions in terms of our system, that we will encounter greater and greater burdens as we go forward. I mean, realistically.
We already are.
Yeah, we're doing it now, but it's going to be on the increase. 1,000 years ago, nobody thought about that kind of stuff. I mean, you could say, well, if you're working in a smithy, a foundry, you're going to be breathing fumes in all day. That could certainly affect your health. But in our case, everybody's getting it, regardless, just because of our exposure to this stuff. So those things factor in, too. But we're trying to get, and we can do we can do something about that. We have certain lifestyle choices and ways we can address our health and well-being to help us with that. But what we're really talking about here is, what about our mind, just our mind itself, and where it's, what it's coming from and what it's doing. So one of the things, so this alia, which is a very important notion to understand and to make friends with, is a way of understanding, it's called a substrate. It's sort of a longer term storage dimension, even though it's not physical, where all these patterns are found. And so when we practice Dharma, we're dealing with learning how to release those things from simply controlling our experience and tying us into knots or putting us into boxes of predictability.
So it's very interesting. I always visualize the eighth consciousness as like the hard drive on a computer, but obviously that's too specific and frozen. But now I was just thinking about every time you're on the internet, you know, all of a sudden they're sending me things because I ordered something from Amazon and now you might want this. So right away they're targeting what they think you want and they figure out your age, I think, and the things that would be of interest to you. So it's almost like you're constantly making these karmic imprints. What's that?
Google is the alia.
There you go. Because it's amorphous. Where is it, right? When I say the hard drive, we visualize a computer and somewhere in there.
No, it's like,
no, it's,
yeah. What are they doing? They're taking algorithms. They're making algorithms out of what they see, these
these patterns.
Actions that we committed by purchasing
or by
going to certain websites and focusing on certain topics, and then they try to form this identity.
Right.
Well, so what actually constitutes, I want to ask the class, what do you understand, having read this and you know, pursuing your own experience and exploration, what do you think constitutes really self-identity?
Mm.
Anybody?
Can you tell me what they mean by the egoic mind, and then I can try?
The egoic mind?
Yeah. I didn't understand what that was.
Well, ego mind, ego does have something to do with identity, right? I mean, we're talking about some reference point we continually have that we consider real entity called me, anyone, right? And we have an identity and we latch onto that. So, I mean, that's the general term.
Where does that fit into the levels of
exactly in my question right now. I'm asking the people, everybody here, for your input, so we can try to understand how, you know, how each of us in our own way could understand what it means to have an identity, a self-identity. And you've been reading, at least if you've read this chapter, he brings up certain points. Anybody have anything they'd like to share that way?
Well, my understanding of the seventh consciousness is that it simply takes whatever it wants to from whatever's coming into mind and says, this is me. That is, it's continually trying to turn whatever the experience is into me by selecting, by ignoring, by promoting, by perhaps by even mixing what's coming up from underneath and what's happening at the present. But always it's trying to create the experience of me. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I'm over my head and just trying to absorb what's going on.
Yeah,
I'm really trying.
So seventh consciousness is, as Michael says, is this idea we have about being somebody, and it takes things to support itself. Mm-hmm. It takes things, it's reacting to stimulus coming at it in terms of what's going on. But it also then draws on elements that are in our eighth consciousness, mm-hmm. which is the background, which holds this kind of series of memories. I mean, I'm giving away what I expect.
Is anybody in charge?
Great question. That's a good question.
That's
the point.
That's a really good question, and that's what we want to do, is explore that question in our meditation practice. Is anybody really here at all to begin with? I mean, we have this idea continuously. Somebody's talking, I this, I that, me this, you that. But I mean, when we actually investigate, is anybody really here at all? Because if we really look where our thoughts come from, where these thoughts about me and what I'm creating, because me and you are coming together as a co-creation in terms of me creating you and then you reifying me. Well, we look for where all this comes from, and at least so far, no one's been able to find anybody there. The Buddhas, the reason why the Buddhas are the Buddhas is because they actually discovered that they couldn't find it. They were looking very hard, much harder than we do, because they had more time. They would go into caves and spend decades meditating 24/7, and they still couldn't, after investigating the source of me, not find it. I mean, nothing's there. It's not there. And when we even look for this mind, we can't find mind, can we? I mean, has anyone actually found mind yet? You know, there's still mind, right? And yes, there's me and you, and we're dealing with this. We're here. I mean, it's not like, you know, we can be real about this.
So one way, you know, I it's very interesting traveling, because I feel like you drop out of your regular life and all the patterns you usually have. And being in San Francisco, we were both there at the same time, although I was looking for you, but I didn't see you. What I love to do is just be in a place and think about all the people that lived there in different times in history. Mm-hmm. And there was an exhibit on the Indians, and the whole bay of San Francisco, they believed, was this fertile grassy plain, which the people talked about in their history, oral history. And then the Spanish, and what their view and how they solidified their view, and then the Mexicans took over, and then Google took over. And you think about everybody, if you slice that across these time frames, everybody's solid in their view of what they think they're doing and what they're believing in. You know, the Catholic mission was right across from my grandson's school, and it was built in, the 1700s. Yes, Mission Dolores. It's the oldest building in San Francisco. As an aside, my daughter had never even gone in there. But anyway, I took her in. And so it's like, you think about how we live in our world, and we see things through these eyes and this view. But actually, it's all just a process that's completely changing all the time. And people have been right here before and seen a completely different world, right in this spot.
Well, but even a spot, but the question is whether the spot is a constant. It just seems
it
to be.
It isn't.
Constant. It seems to be, because we're here and it's staying here as long as we are. It's not like the walls are shifting and windows are.
Unless they do.
Over.
They do. They do, actually.
They do. In California, they really do.
Right.
So
exactly.
Identity is it the places that sporadically where the seventh and eighth conscious meet for a brief period of time and then transform and change. And
what do you say?
Say that again.
Where the seventh and eighth consciousnesses, they intersect, they bow, and then they move on to the next whatever.
Well, they're constantly interacting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a process.
But that's what I mean by identity. Identity is so... But it's flickering.
Actually practice meditation, and we simply see thought, but we just recognize thinking and relax, and relax into the space. You know, suddenly there is a snap. Mm-hmm. We're not just doing this kind of like chain link thing of one thought next to the next to the next to the next, eating up and consuming our attention. We're actually finding out that there's more. There's a deeper space, an open space. Mm-hmm. And so we've been talking about this for some time, and this is really important, because this is where that power of thought controlling us can start to change. Mm-hmm. We wear them down because we're not supporting them. They know, every time we practice meditation, every time we give ourselves some room to actually see thinking, and relax, and not simply go with it, not simply believe it, but just simply relax at that moment. You know, suddenly there's a lot more freedom available to us that we didn't know we had. Because before that, it's just like, this is how it is. We're going there.
The train.
Yeah.
We got on the train, right? As opposed to just standing on the platform of the station. We had that metaphor recently.
So if I can ask you, the forms disappear if one meditates and somehow drops into a different state of mind of non-form. So it's like I don't know the word for it, but there are pictures, about pixels, so to speak, and then if you look at them and you defocus long enough, you can see an image in it. Mm-hmm. So is that what you're saying in terms of your meditation when you drift into a deeper non-contingent set of forms, you end up with sort of a continuous non-formed a non-image.
Well,
I was just wondering, you raised that word contingent, which I think is kind of interesting, because it seems that everything is contingent, that nothing is not contingent, and that seems to be the whole point, is that what we feel as ourselves is solid, defined, in this moment. If you look us 10 minutes ago, or 10 weeks ago, or 10 years ago, it's a completely different set of circumstances that were required to make us feel
make one feel like oneself. And all of those situations, one can assume, have morphed into something else in these periods of time and have been in constant interaction and constant change. So, and that's in terms of your use of the word contingent. And I just wanted to get back to Mary Esther's wonderful question, which is, who's in charge? Who's who?
You asking me?
I mean, really.
Well, I think it's a net result of the brain. Now, if you say, what's the brain? The brain is a changing concept, construct. And
I'm sorry, I don't want to... You've got no more time.
Well, I don't want to get away from the topic that's
right,
here.
Right.
I actually want to stick with karma right now.
Yeah.
And not with the physiology of the brain.
Right.
Talking about specifically how this presentation suggests that karma works. And what they're saying is that karma works because of two things. One is that we have the alaya, which is the psychic imprints that are going on constantly, these storylines. How Pema Chodron talks about we carry around these storylines? Well, there they are. That's where we keep them. We got a little bag here, of stuff. And that's where we're carrying our stories. So these stories, some of them have been forgotten, but they're there. Some of them are very fresh and strong, and others are more really remote. But the fact is, they get activated, or they emerge as a result of circumstances which draw them out. Mm-hmm. And then this seventh consciousness, which is this this afflicted, we call afflicted mind, basically...
we've heard the word klesha.
Klesha mantra. It basically is confused and is basically subject to or consists of basically toxic and fundamentally misguided thinking and impulses. Then it goes into the sixth consciousness, which is the mind itself, which is just simply the organizing principle, and infects it with its own commands. It takes it, pulls it out of the seventh, eighth consciousness, the bag, and takes it and puts it into the sixth consciousness. So we're going from eight through seven to six, and then that basically... This helps, that frames up how our perceptions are going to be interpreted, how they're going to be seen, what we're going to look for. For instance, how we can sit in a room like this, and the elephant's here, but we don't know it, I mean, because we're all focused on a Monopoly game in the floor here, and we don't know that there are three elephants in the room in the back, because we're so focused on this. But we've decided what's important through basically doing this... I'm just using that as an example of how we can get so focused or so distracted, as it were. In other words, instead of really being present to the entire space in the room, acknowledging what's going on, we're just involved with one little portion or two little portions of it because that's what our current obsession or focus is. And so this is going to... We don't have a lot of time. We've got a lot of material to cover. But this is... I want to summarize how this is keeping us in a state of fixation and continuous distraction from really what's there. Because what's there is really what matters. We want to be in reality. I mean, the only reason we study Dharma is to understand what's real. You know, that's actually what it's about. I mean, we do want to also feel better. We want to basically, but hopefully seeing reality will make us feel better. I mean, the idea is that it will. And the people who do see reality seem to be much better off than the people who don't. So, that's kind of simply put. To just basically tie it down in one sentence here. I'm sorry, I lost it again. The last sentence on this page, on page 64, just sort of summarizes what the Yogacharans were talking about. But they helped to understand, develop this notion of how the mind works by describing this eight levels of consciousness. And they made it more apparent that karma perpetuates through the interactions between levels of consciousness. The alaya vijnana impacts the egoic mind, that's the seventh consciousness. The egoic mind impacts the sense consciousnesses, and then the reverse order, because it goes back and forth, because it's all interdependent. And the sense, and so back and forth. And so that talks about how we are going in circles. When we talk about samsara, the word samsara, it means to go in circles, again and again and again, circling. So we're getting some picture of how samsara works. Now, that takes us to the Bardo teachings on death, intermediate state, and rebirth. So,
and life, stressful.
Well, yeah. And of course, he said he doesn't spend a lot of time talking about the Bardo of this life, but actually, it's the Bardo of this life where we can actually understand these things at all. And that we can actually engage in meditation practice to allow us to actually develop confidence and recognize the strength we have, which is intrinsic to our own nature, to go beyond this life and not just end up being a donkey, you know, after you've woken up from a dream. So that's why meditation and the path, bringing your practice onto the path, is so important, because we are certainly thinking about how we can deal with problems and issues we have in this life. But we didn't just get here from nowhere. I mean, the things that we just talked about, the karma that brought us into this life, how we are, why are we here now? Why are we in this time of history together? Why are we asking these questions together? What brought us together like this? We already have share a mutual karma this way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can celebrate that, or we can curse it, depending on how you want to deal with it. But the fact is, we share this karma. And learning about what this karma is critical, because it doesn't end here. It doesn't end when we die. Check out. And the problems we have in this life become even more magnified when we die. By that I mean the thinking and the distraction that we've just been discussing.
Oh, wait a minute. We got a reaction over there.
No, your sentence, the problems we have in this life will be even worse when we die.
Well, the reason I say that, is because this body is an anchor. You know, I mean, we can always come back and use the body as simply an anchor of stability. I mean, I might not be feeling great today, but at least I'm here, and I can use this scanning my body and simply being here as a point of an anchor of simplicity and straightforward. Well, I'm here. I mean, I'm going to be just practical, pragmatic about the whole thing. I'm not tomorrow in some science fiction movie. You know, I'm not in a historical romance, which, you know, maybe I'd like to be there, but it's not. So I'm here. I can work with that. I have my body to orient myself. When I don't have my body, I'm just my psyche floating all over the place, and it means the issues that have plagued me in what I experience as myself are not going to be unhindered. They're not going to be hindered by having to deal with the body. It means I got to get practical. I got to go to sleep. I have to eat. I got to bathe. I have to take care of myself. I got to work. You know, all those practical factors come in. Well, they actually act as a stabilization of some sort. Believe it or not, we don't have the body. What are we going to do? We're going to do whatever our mind comes into our mind. Yeah. So when we talk about a Bardo body, which is the mind outside of the body at death, then this mind can go anywhere it wants. And that could be a problem. Because, you know, it's just subject to its own impulses. When we talk about the karmic imprints and all the habitual patterns, the storylines we carry around in our little bag, they're going to be able to just go full tilt without anything else to bring us back to, wait a minute, you know, back to breath, you know. So if we understand that's the principle, that fundamentally meditation becomes extremely important in understanding Dharma, because it helps us, it's going to help us understand how to die properly. You know, living and dying we're always dying a little bit somehow in different ways. our ideas about who we are is dying, for one thing, continuously. We can't maintain it as much as we'd like. Our thoughts about what's meaningful are changing. You could say they're refining, or in some cases they could be going downhill. Right? But I mean, you know, and certain things are always going downhill, other things are going uphill. You know, it's like this continuous multi-elevator going in different levels. And so, you know, our living is this opportunity to actually take some kind of, discover some basic sanity, and that we recognize that this is potentially the most precious thing we have, is just simple sanity. As no nonsense, kind of just straightforward willingness to see things as they are. Yes.
I have a question. So are you using dying and changing in a pretty synonymous way? It seems like you're sort of interchanging.
The only difference is that the big deal is our body that we think is permanent, but it's always changing anyway.
Right.
You know, stops. So the body factors we have won't work with us beyond death. However, our mind persists.
Is that a belief throughout Buddhism, or this particular part, this particular
school?
School.
No. Buddhism generally accepts that there is a fundamental continuity of this thing we call habitual patterns.
Uh-huh.
Psychic you know, storylines that we carry around. Now, they're always going to change to fit the situation, mm-hmm. particularly when you're in a body, because you're going to be born in a culture and a living dynamic with parents, family, and everything else that's going to inform how you're going to be able to carry on. And some stories will be suppressed because there'll be no room for them. They can't even find a simple point to hook in. Others could flourish that have been dormant for other times. Just like we could find ourselves in different circumstances or different relationships with people, and all kinds of different dynamics come out that we couldn't even know or even access in those other ones.
And something occurred to me that our karma in this sense can change within a lifetime. It isn't that you maintain the same. Look what's happened to Bernie Madoff and to all these people who were one way and now have lost everything, or so on and so forth. So, so it's as fixed and flexible as our.
And we're right now at a point in time when everything is moving very fast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not an agrarian economy where things were just based on the seasons and that's all there is to it. And, you know, I go out, I make the farm and I trade and my life is predetermined by the family and the place I was born into. I mean, this is so, we know already. And things are flying so fast. What was seemingly optimal in the past, even 20 years ago, could be completely defunct in terms of having any kind of useful value. Yes.
So, am I correct in thinking that when our mind is inhabiting a body, that is an optimal time to clear out and move through and, yes, change? But when you're just in the bardo and your floating mind out there, there's not an opportunity to change.
Pretty much. All we know is what we can do now is instill. We can talk about it from fighting fire with fire by instilling habits. If we establish a habit of actually a willingness to disengage and see things dispassionately, do you know what I mean? I'm just clearly and developed clear, what we call, there's a term called clear light. So we'll get right into this because we want time for questions and so on. Is he introduces the notion of how can we deal with our impurities. And so he introduces the notion that in tantric Buddhism, we have deity practice. Now what that means is it's not necessarily the only way to go, but what it does is, he's using it as an example of how we can basically use our mind to create a possibility of complete purity. In reality, the ultimate teachings say everything is completely pure already. We don't see it because of our confused mind, but because by creating through our own power of visualization a deity that is pure, that reflects that purity, you know, to some degree it's an act of faith, but we have to have faith in our own capacity to do this. We have to have faith to get up in the morning and make the day good. You know, there's always going to be encountering oppositions and difficulties and challenges. The point is that through this visualization practice that we actually learn how to change our mind. Our mind actually transforms our perceptions into something pure. So what the consequence of that is, or the result of this practice, is what we call deity. In other words, everything is fundamentally deity, meaning it's completely pure. It's sacred.
Can you give a definition of purity?
Purity in this sense means completely free of any conceptual bias. It's completely open, and also it's connected with the notion of emptiness. Emptiness is not a vacuum. Emptiness is a complete state of openness and a complete state of open heart. They're not separate. Open heart, open space, open mind.
Yeah.
And that's what deity is.
Deity is just that. And it's naturally radiant. So this emptiness is radiant. It's not just like, okay, emptiness, you know. No, it's actually like everything is completely vivid and alive.
Deity is representation of that.
Deity is representation of that. So we are using that as a representation, not as an end in itself, because as he says, when we create deity practice, then we dissolve it. Because even though we do it, we realize we actually create the deity out of nothing, as it were, out of emptiness. And that through a seed syllable, which is like a dot in space, which gives rise to this deity. Each deity in the teachings we have corresponds to a seed syllable, or kind of like a basic seed which contains this whole potential deity. So the deity arises out of that, and we basically play with that. We actually identify with that as our own self nature.
The word, I'm hung up on the word deity, because I keep thinking like we're inventing another kind of theism.
So the deity is a wisdom being. It's the expression of wisdom. So there are different deities.
It's symbolic too.
Symbolic.
It's not a real thing.
But it
well,
carries.
Neither are theistic religions, but creating a theistic way.
It's not theistic because we're creating it out of emptiness itself. It's arising out of emptiness through our power of our mind, and at the same time, and what's very important, whenever we do this practice, we have two stages. One's called creation, which is the actual creation of the deity, the visualization, and then there's completion stage, and that we dissolve, we return it to emptiness.
So look, if your experience is going to be very different than mine, for example, because I've had a certain level of Buddhist training. So if your experience of deity is Jesus, for example, mm-hmm. then the same thing can apply. That is, can you see how to take the image of Jesus rather than as something that you get hung up on in a fixed way, but as something that your mind can see an intrinsic purity to and go beyond the background that you were taught.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that could be your work as opposed to mine. I don't know. I can't tell you what your work is, but you can't do what those of us who have had Buddhist deities do because you haven't had them.
But you could.
You have to find what's in your life somehow and purify it and not be hung up on what you were taught about and so on.
So if you want to look at the Western tradition, like the Christian tradition, they have alchemy. And, you know, alchemy is really very related to deity practice. Because in deity, you're transforming base kind of emotional and defiled states into purity, into enlightened states, which is actually what they are. When we studied the skandhas earlier, and we discussed all those, the skandhas and all of their neuroses that come along with them, we also discussed the fact that they're all inseparable from the Buddha nature, which is going to be, and there are these families of Buddhas which basically correspond to the actual poisons or emotional poisons or states of delusion that make us up. And so what we're doing is recognizing we are all Buddha mind. This is the important thing. Nobody is not Buddha here. Everybody is Buddha. Everybody's true nature is Buddha. This is the principle.
And everyone's a deity.
That's right. The deity, however, has to be recognized as a state, a stage. You're employing it for a stage, like the alchemists do, who are taking like poisons. I don't know if you ever read an alchemical manual. They take urine and they take mercury and they take all kinds of other strange things, and they put them together through these oral instructions from a master, who then transforms into gold. And the idea of alchemy was to transform gross substances into something glorious and pure. And so, I mean, you could say this is metaphorical, but that's fine. But the point is, it is. I mean, we are using our mind to create something, to transform our mind. We're using our mind to transform. We have these powers. It's within us. Because the whole principle is we are already creating what we experience right now. Everything we experience and see is our own projection.
Can I go back to something a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you have your vision of Mary Magdalena, you see that she was not hung up by Christian dogma. In fact, she had no idea of that. She wasn't even bound by the concept of what's valuable in terms of money and what goes beyond that and can be offered as a pure offering of love. And you have had that, and you can see that that's not that's very different than any kind of a dogma. And you can look at that in your experience. If that's your experience. Again, I don't know, but I don't think you can go by Buddha experiences.
Okay.
Is that useful or not?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, because we want to understand there's a lot of different spiritual traditions that have employed the very thing we're discussing, but in very different ways.
Yeah.
And so the tradition that we're working with, you know, the teachers here have been working with Tibetan Buddhism and this, and that employs deity practice. But that's not the only thing that is possible. But the important thing is that the mind has the capacity, just as it has the capacity to create our reality here and now as we are here, it has the capacity to transform that the things that we find are hindering us from really experiencing the truth. Yeah, at least.
So I guess the question I had is sort of those practices, different kind of practices, is that a way that we actually can change what's in that eighth consciousness? Or
yeah.
Not?
Yeah. So well, that's what happens, we talk about it liberating.
Liberating
those elements. So the idea is there is a deeper, ultimate kind of space beyond the eighth consciousness.
Right.
And it's actually present in that eighth consciousness, but it's the reason we don't see it or access it easily is because we got all these other things in there.
It's sort of like clouds that are wandering around.
Yeah, exactly.
We keep seeing them and saying that's what's in the sky.
And that's what's distracting us. So we keep on thinking, yeah, this is what I'm so involved with my stories that I don't see that there's something beyond all these stories that's actually the real thing, which is what we all are. And that's the important thing. And we share this. Ultimately, it's not like privately. It's not like I got my little private secret super duper space beyond the alley. It's like we got this is where we are all fundamentally sharing basic awareness.
Okay.
basic Buddha mind.
So it's sort of like when we all look up at the clouds, and I see this, and you see that, and you see the other thing. And really the point is there's that whole big sky, and we're just looking at the little cloud.
Well, we recognize beyond the clouds, to use that metaphor, there's the sun. And it doesn't matter whether there are clouds there or not. The sun's still there, regardless. And it's going to be there anyway all the time. So that sun, that principle, is basically what's going on. And so we stop feeling like the clouds are going to determine our entire way of being or living. Mm-hmm. Even though there are going to be clouds, and actually begin to work with the clouds, we can begin to see them in a different way.
And also how we can see other people. So if you really think about Buddha nature, instead of seeing everyone's basic badness or everyone is really evil or bad, actually, if you go from this point of view, it flips it to this foundational, the real essence is actually Buddha nature, that the potential is there in everyone. So if we can see that, then it can change how we interact or how we relate on the other side, rather than putting another type of label on that just shuts down the whole situation.
It separates us.
Yeah.
And so when we actually see each other as Buddha, then we recognize there's no separation. I mean, we actually experience that. And, you know, while we understand, let's not get confused. I mean, there are a lot of mixed up people. You know, we're not conflating that with, but we recognize the teachings are that anybody who's a sentient being, meaning anyone who experiences feelings and who experiences any kind of presence of life and moves, is a sentient being. And that sentient being ultimately is Buddha. Nature is Buddha.
And you can see how compassion comes out of that view, because the compassionate activity arises based on that shared maybe it's not shared understanding, but maybe you see something.
The present. A shared presence.
Yeah. The shared present.
You're present.
You're in the same.
You're in the same.
You're in the same. You're in the same now. And
in the same now.
The now is
the now.
Everybody is now.
That's acknowledged.
Whether they like it or not, we really are now. This is it. Yeah. This is the only thing that's really happening.
Well, and then it comes from, like my saying, I sometimes get stuck on looking at the cloud, but now I see that that's just behind. The other person may still be stuck.
Right.
Looking at the cloud.
Right.
Well, I was that person.
Right.
A lot of times I'm that person.
Well, so compassion is always... It's the DNA of now.
Yeah. Right. And it arises spontaneously, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the point?
I think it's like we recognize if everyone fundamentally in truth is the space beyond the clouds. Mm-hmm. In other words, everyone has that same energy of the sky with the sun in it, and that's the fundamental reality. When we actually begin to know this, we begin to realize that, and there's no fundamental separation between us, then this compassion is not such a difficult thing to understand because we share the same heart.
The name of ego, that's what ego, what we label ego, is that when you're holding on to your little piece of now,
what you think is now.
Or what you think is now. Yeah, you're holding on to it versus recognizing the sort of wider sky, sun. Right?
Is this making sense?
Does that make sense?
It's coming together.
It's a weird phrase. It takes time to process this.
And, you know, I think the meditation is really critical because we have this thing in Dharma called learning, contemplating, and meditating. And another thing he brings up in this karma principle is this thing called wisdom, that's called prajna, and then there's samadhi or meditation. So wisdom, meditation, and then ethics, which is sila, and those three. But the important thing is there's a priority to these things, because without the wisdom mind or without the perception, the capacity to recognize, which is our fundamental natural state of our mind, that takes precedence, so that the meditation helps us stabilize and learn about that mind and learn about how to connect with it and realize we're not separate from it and build into our lives. And then the ethics is how we live as a result of this understanding. So we conduct ourselves in such a way we are not creating problems for other people. We're actually reducing the pollution of the mind and the body through...
Can I say something, too?
Yeah.
So, I guess we're coming to the end. But I'm thinking about what this chapter is actually an introduction to the process of death. And I just wanted to read on page 71 about, you know, what is this, these Bardo teachings, and this space beyond in terms of the body. The Bardo teachings, this is halfway down in the middle, the Bardo teachings as a whole, then, are meant to instruct the practitioner in two fundamental things. Death is not something to be feared, and after-death experiences can be utilized for our own benefit. Not only is death not to be feared, it needs to be appreciated as affording us an opportunity for transformation. It signifies a freedom from all the constraints that contain us while alive, family obligations, social connections, etc. And
onward,
yes,
people who have been put in mortal danger know something of this. The way, you know, you're ever almost cut and killed in an accident or something where suddenly time stops and you're just there. And the way time and reality seem to be compressed in an inexplicable way, and yet such people report the experience to be enormously transformative. Many transformers recount having gained a new lease on life. All the stuff carried around for a lifetime, unable to be shifted, a burden, is suddenly thrown off their back. People who, for instance, get into an accident, for instance, lose control of the lower part of their body. So oftentimes they discover, this is when I really start to live. I suddenly woke up. I suddenly realized I got to make use of everything I have, and this is it. And they get inspired by a setback like that rather than just destroyed by it. At the time of death, everything is compressed and the mind becomes incredibly focused, crystal clear and sharp, beyond distraction and laziness. Consciousness becomes very refined and subtle, still and penetratingly present. There is no disturbance, which generates an immense amount of mental and psychic energy and affords individuals a great opportunity for awakening and working through their karma. Now, that means, however, that we have to be a little bit familiarized with this in order to recognize it, because it's said that for people who are totally caught up and just one thought after the other, completely being ruled by the impulses, is, you know, this moment just happens like a flash, and they're just, it's like they pass out. They don't recognize what it is. So as we gain this experience, and meditation provides us this opportunity of learning how to become acquainted with being introduced to space, we realize it's always there, but we never notice it. And as we become more familiar, we begin to realize this space is not just thought of space, it's actually quite alive, and it's actually the phenomenal nature of awareness, which is present without a reference point. So that's what we're going to learn. And even though there's a moment of death when that clarity could come, and you have it, you recognize it, and if you can really recognize it and just be there with it, then suddenly you don't have to go through this chain of cause and effect, because it's beyond cause and effect. And we have this around us all the time. It's not only at that point. And so if we can make good use of this life, learning how to actually discovering space, discovering the nature of meditative awareness, and integrating it with what we do, how we experience our things, beyond just sitting on a cushion.
Eric. So, do you think lucid dreaming is a step towards that?
Yeah, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not everyone can do it, but if you can, then that's great. It's definitely a tremendous boost to health.
What is lucid dreaming? I don't know what that is.
Knowing, being present in your dreams. You're awake, you understand you're dreaming. You know you're dreaming.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
If you're really interested in that, my friend Andrew Holacek teaches that, and he just offered something online that you pay like a fee for the year, and then there's all these steps and things you can participate in. If that's something you want to spend time on or work on, let me know, and I'll forward you that email if you're interested.
Okay, well, we've that's reached the magic name. Hour again. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Think about what we've been discussing and bring more questions next week so that, we can continue this conversation continuing rather than chopped up and start a whole new topic.